Hello, this is Dr. Peter Matthews from the University of Stirling from the Faculty of Social Sciences doing a podcast with Dan Theakston for Understanding Social Policy on Disability and Social Policy. So we've talked so far in our podcasts about the different models of disability, and then we talked generally in the last podcast about why we need to consider social policy and disability because of the fact that disabled people have specific needs that social policy delivers, but also the social policy, it can be disabling. In we ended with the example of the choice-based letting system around social housing excluding people. But we mentioned in our last discussion the bedroom tax, or the abolition of the spare room subsidy, as the UK government like to call it. And that brings us on to a bigger topic, which is the support, particularly through the welfare benefits system, that disabled people get, and how, and the changes that are happening through the UK government into that system. So I know there's quite a lot of changes, but Diane, do you just want to outline what some of the big changes over the last few years have been to the benefits system?
Okay, well, I suppose you've already mentioned the bedroom tax there.
Yeah.
Spare bedroom tax. So that was one of the big changes that came out, and Scottish Government brought out discretionary payments to try and combat it, really. So that was one change.
And just for the students, so you'll for the students on campus, you'll be discussing this in the workshop during semester, but this was a change where people who were in social housing, who received housing benefit to pay their rent, if they were perceived to have a spare bedroom, then their housing benefit was reduced by 25% for that bedroom. And was it 5% for every bedroom above that, for each extra bedroom? It's quite, And this particularly affected disabled people, particularly when they needed an extra room for a lot of their adaptations and equipment that helped them live their lives. Mm. And there's been some sort of really horrible cases.
Carers. Stay over. Yeah, so that was one big change. Another big change would obviously be the shift to PIP.
Yes.
From the old system, which was DLA, Disability Living Allowance.
Now, as I understand it, the Disability Living Allowance, that was very much the sort of inspired by the independent living movement, wasn't it? It was very much about giving disabled people support to live independently.
It was, and I think with PIP, the problem has been about the way that people have been reassessed, really, and the whole kind of processes around it.
Mm.
So DLA, for example, came out, and part of that was to challenge the kind of medical model approach to how benefits were assessed. And there were stories of people would turn up to these assessments. There was kind of centralised buildings where they would go for an assessment. And part of the assessment, without them knowing, was people watching them getting out of the car, or however they arrived, and judging how much help they needed across the car park. So, of course, lots of people would be coming out and an extra boost of energy because they would be thinking that they're going to get, extra support. And they would get knocked down, if they look too able to come across that car park without any assistance. So DLA really came out to challenge these kind of medical assessments of disabled people. But unfortunately, PIP has been challenged for going a step backwards because, again, it's come out with this kind of like checklisty boxes of how much can a person do or not do. So it's very prescriptive, and instead of being more kind of open-ended and saying and shifting the emphasis upon, okay, tell me what you can do, because in some situations you can do something, but perhaps with a little bit of support, there's lots of challenges. I know that the early draft of PIP was challenged by, for example, the RNIB and guide dogs, because if you had a a guide dog or a form of assistance dog, that would actually count against you, being as more able than somebody who was perhaps a cane user. So there was lots of challenges to that, because they were saying, well, it doesn't make you more able compared to somebody who's a cane user. You've got the same needs, you've got the same challenges. And actually, you have to tell the dog where to go in order to navigate. So there was lots of assumptions built into the early forms of PIP, which have been kind of tackled. And I think especially for people with cognitive impairments, it's hit people in that group particularly hard. Because, again, it's got this focus on what can you do and what can't you do. And a lot of people with cognitive impairments can perhaps walk in a straight line for 100 metres and do things like that. But when it comes to remembering, you know, to go for the shopping, pay bills, do all these kind of daily living things, then that's where they need support. So it's not tailored enough, the assessment criteria, to take all those kind of aspects as well.
And the UK government say it isn't, but I gather there's a widespread sense among disability activists that the shift from DLA to PIP was made to reduce the budget and the amount of money spent on benefits for disabled people.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, and there is also this feeling that because we've had this period of austerity, that one of the mechanisms that they've been trying to reduce budgets is by looking at the benefit system and seeing whereabout they can save. And one of the words that they've been using is personalised services, which sounds great and it sounds fluffy and it sounds, you know, it sounds like you're being person-centred and meeting people's needs. But in reality, it's about trying to reduce people's support as much as possible to give them the bare minimum.
Yeah.
And there's lots of accounts of people's support being reduced to the bare minimum where, okay, they can get out of bed, they can have breakfast, and that's them until lunchtime or the next mealtime. In between times, they might not have the necessary support to socialise or go out shopping and do all these sorts of things, which are just equally as important as the essential bodily needs, like assistance to get out of bed or use the toilet and things like that.
I'm gonna play devil's advocate here, though, because I know the one I know a bit about is disability benefit, which, as I understand, it was brought in the early 1990s. And what happened there was people who were long-term unemployed would then understandably end up with mental health issues, usually depression. And then benefits advisors for local authorities were quite rightly advising them to move on to disability benefit, so off job seekers allowance onto disability benefit, because the benefit was higher, so their income would be higher. But that was meaning that those people became excluded from the labour market. There was no support put in place for them to get back to work. And I know that's been one of the long-term arguments around that difficult interaction between the benefit system and disabled people, is how do you ensure that the system is supporting disabled people to do what they can, particularly in terms of the labour market and working, and not inadvertently excluding them by the pejorative right wing way to put it would be live a nice life on benefits.
On benefits, exactly. Yes. And it'll be like Benefit Street.
So I suppose that's the kind of the counter argument.
Yes. Well, I mean, and I suppose this is kind of where my personal views come through a little bit, but there is that argument that whoever you are, you need a certain amount to live on and a certain amount of income to have a good enough standard of living, otherwise you would end up with lots of people who are in poverty, bad health, and it's just a spiral, and it's not going to go anywhere at all because people get into bad health, bad housing, homelessness. And then how do you get people out of that cycle? So I think underneath it all, you need a basic welfare net, if you like, to support people to have a good enough basic conditions, like housing and a roof over their head, and they can eat and things like that. And then where I think it falls down, like I know you're talking about this support to get people into work, and I think that's where it falls down, because we need more, and this is one of the challenges of universal credit, but we need more personalised interaction with people, to work with them, and which of course needs time and resources, but getting people to build up their self-confidence and build up the skills so that they can go into a work environment and, you know, have the support mechanisms in place to allow that to happen. And also at the other end within work, to have employers to, like we mentioned, I think it was in the first podcast, about having, you know, flexible ways of working, maybe thinking out the box about how they could support people a bit more. So I think there has to be more support built into the whole process along the way. I think at the moment it's very much focused upon punishing the individual for not engaging and not securing a job at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Whereas I think if you start punishing people too severely, then, you know, things just start to spiral out of control. They lack self-esteem, self-confidence, they won't try to build up their skills, they won't try to engage with even like voluntary work. And then, you know, it just gets worse and worse.
And it sounds like there's a what we term a policy discourse that on the face of it looks very positive. It's about supporting disabled people, allowing disabled people to live independently, helping disabled people into work. But there's, because of the actual reality of the policy decisions and the cuts in the budgets, that that support isn't there.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think even with existing support, like access to work, that we've mentioned already, there have been scares around, is that going to get cut back? Is it going to get completely done away with?
Yeah.
You know, and getting rid of support mechanisms like that, okay, they would help with the budgets and how they look.
Yeah.
But the end of the long-term effects is that it wouldn't do disabled people any help in the long term. And the numbers would increase in unemployment. And also for employers, because they'd be less likely, if they knew there wasn't any support in place, they'd be less likely to employ disabled people too.
I suppose, and the other thing we should have probably mentioned much earlier in these podcasts is we're not exactly talking a small number of people here, are we? Is it a fifth of the population estimated to be disabled?
Yes.
In some way, so it's not we're not talking a handful of people who are scrounging for the state. We're talking a fifth of society who needs some support.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do have, under the Equalities Act in 2010, they have brought out measures for positive action. Which is, if you have two job candidates who are equal in terms of their performance in interviews and everything like that, that the employers to favour the disabled candidate in that situation, you know, where they're completely equal.
It allows
positive discrimination at the moment.
Well, it's not quite positive discrimination, because that's the more American civil rights approach, but it allows you
positive action.
Which is subtly different, but
But
the other thing
again, it's very difficult to measure, isn't it?
It is, But I suppose the other thing you mentioned there as well was Benefit Street, the infamous Channel 4 documentary. And there has been this broader discourse in society about welfare benefits and about kind of benefit scroungers. And has that particularly affected disabled people?
It has, and negatively, actually, because a lot of the stereotyping that's happening, particularly in the media and within, you know, the newspapers and internet blogs and things like that, is very negative towards people who receive welfare. And of course, disabled people being part of that group. And one of the results is that the numbers of hate crime against disabled people is on the increase. And I was actually reading an article, I think it was only 2 weeks ago actually, that was saying that out of all the equalities, disabled hate crime is the one that has just jumped up the way. And part of this is because, you know, these stereotypes of people not trying to get a job and scrounging and this kind of shifting the blame to the individual, the disabled individual, for not being able to get a job.
So
it's attracting all of that. So,
and I suppose it's also, it links back to an earlier discussion we had in one of the earlier podcasts about the different models of disability as well. And I think there's a presumption of disabled people being wheelchair users, having an obvious physical impairment, whereas actually when the range of disability is very wide. So somebody might be very disabled, but you won't know from looking at them, basically.
Exactly. Yes. Because a lot of cognitive impairments are invisible. And you wouldn't be able to tell if you were just looking at somebody. And also some of the sensory impairments as well, you know, people that are perhaps partially sighted or partially deaf. You can't necessarily tell by looking at them as well.
There's also variable conditions as well, which you mentioned as well, that there's sort of, you will end up being on benefits because your condition is so variable. You might be very well for a very long period of time, but when you're not well and you can't work, you need support, then you need the welfare benefits net there to support you.
Yes, absolutely. And there was a good example that came out of the project that I was involved with recently about allocations of adapted social housing. And one of the organisations that I was talking to, the staff were telling me about a family where the husband was a wheelchair user, and he... early 20s-ish, but they couldn't quite work out why all of a sudden he was unable to walk and his condition just kept deteriorating. So it's also to do with like nerves in his back, but they just couldn't quite pinpoint, you know, one of these things, what was causing it. So he was on the waiting list for a while, managed to get a lovely fully accessible wheelchair house, and then after 6 months his condition actually improved and he could walk around. And the staff said that the first she knew was because his neighbours all of a sudden are like, oh, how's he got this house, because he's walking around and he can he can be mobile. But of course his condition could go back down the way any time. I mean, they don't know if this is permanent or not, you know. But there was also this bad feeling because people started to feel that he didn't deserve that house now.
Which usefully kind of almost, it takes us back to that patrician model of the welfare state that came from the medical model of presuming people were disabled for all their lives and they needed the support of the welfare state to live their lives in the way that the welfare state taught them to, and they were the deserving poor, to go right back to that 1834 Poor Law Amendment Act idea. And we sort of return to this dividing the population into deserving,
that's right,
and undeserving.
And undeserving,
yeah.
That's right, I think because you have resources which are so scarce, like the accessible housing, or if it's, you know, the cash for benefits, because everything is so scarce, it's almost like people are so competitive each other over it. Yes.
Well, that's really useful. And we'll wrap up our podcast there. Thank you very much, Diane.